Hey, this is Chuck. I'm super excited to announce that my podcast, Post Traumatic Church Disorder, is coming back and will be joining the Farsighted Network. All of my back episodes are going to drop on farsightedblog.com, and I'm really excited to get back into it. We're going to be discussing things like the death of the megachurch, why I left evangelical Christianity behind, and how to be a Christian in the age of Trump. All of that and a ton of other totally non-controversial subjects on the Post Traumatic Church Disorder podcast right here on the Farsighted Network.
What about it, Nikki? Is it socially positive?
Well, I think we live in overstimulated times. We crave stimulation for its own sake. We gorge ourselves on it. We always want more, whether it's tactile, emotional, or sexual. And I think that's bad.
Days are short, time gets longer, patience short. I just wander, pacing forward like a monster. To go, you're dead from the start. Mark of the beast, heart that I eat. Onto the teeth, an intellect sharply indifferent. Food for thought, they force feed that blah 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 of applause. I got a suicide that's forming a warning for a deadly price. Oh no, I'm not the steady type. I'm lost in heady highs. I'm an artist, man. I'm drawn to sketchy types. Rats in the bucket that I'll probably kick if I don't watch them. Hashtag my blood, but there's no audience for psychodrama. Look what the tiger brought to me. By dishonor, ultraviolet on it. Show me where they had the body. Inside the audio, I probably own a few examples. Tooth enamel planted in the hand that fed a losing battle. Soon see actors, gloomy atmosphere can steer me to these shadows. Blue sea back on multi adults. All the blessings they throw at you.
To another episode out of the year 2018 with Grindhouse Messiah. I, as usual, am your co-host, Blaine McLaren, and with me is, of course, the other co-host,
Justin Harlan. And thanks for kicking us off, Blaine. As folks are listening, you know, this is going to be our second episode here in the year of 2018, and we're really excited to have our first guest of the year on. And before we introduce him, let me just start by saying thanks to our sponsor, Vinegar Syndrome. If you guys are not aware of Vinegar Syndrome, then I don't know how the hell you're a fan of our show, because they put out some of the best exploitation and horror and just weird freaking movies and Blaine's favorite grandpa porn, right, Blaine?
Oh, absolutely. And there's tons. There's so much good porn coming out this over these next few months for us all to enjoy for Vinegar Syndrome. Lots of bushes, lots of weird incestual titles. So, yeah, man, make sure that everyone's supporting them. And if you didn't get a chance on our last episode, we did break down our favorite releases from Vinegar Syndrome in 2017. So that's a lot
and
of
I'm
fun.
Sure we'll be talking about some new releases of theirs on our next episode once we get a chance to check out the January package. So stay tuned for that. And the little voice in the background you heard chuckling at Blaine's discussion of porn is our first guest, the one and only Graham Skipper. How's it going, Graham?
Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to the future.
Thank you, sir. No, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us a chance to talk about some movies that I think we all at least like to certain varying degrees here, and excited to chat about them with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to get trippy with you guys.
Nice. So for those folks listening that aren't very familiar with you, Graham, can you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit and, you know, kind of what you do as far as film goes and, you know, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, sure. I sort of got my start in the horror world I had the incredible luck of getting cast as Herbert West in Reanimated the Musical, directed by the master of horror, Stuart Gordon. Then it was from there that I met Joe Bigas, and that's how I got involved with Almost Human. And I mean, acting-wise, Almost Human, Beyond the Gates, The Mind's Eye, Tales of Halloween, Carnage Park. I don't know, I've been doing a lot of indie horror stuff. This past year, I wrote and directed my first feature film called Sequence Break that has been touring around the festival circuit and comes out on Shudder this year.
Nice. And Blaine and I both got a chance to watch Sequence Break, and we're both big fans. Before we get to that film, I had asked you to bring a couple films with you this week that we could talk about, that were inspirations to you with this film and as a filmmaker.
Yeah. Definitely, you know, the two movies that inspired Sequence Break the most, I would say are Videodrome and Altered States. And when you see the film, you can definitely see their fingerprints, you know, sort of all over it. My intention with Sequence Break was really to kind of take what those movies bring to the table in terms of a stylized way of telling a story, a relationship with technology, and sort of a way to take the lives of the characters and kind of expand them in a metaphorical sense, you know, kind of out into the cosmos. So I wanted to get trippy with it. I wanted to you know, to really take my characters down a rabbit hole. So these two particular films were really great examples for me of how these great filmmakers have accomplished that in the past. And so I wanted to take those and kind of use them as a jumping off point to morph into my own thing. They're two movies that I love very much and two filmmakers that I love very much, both of whom I find to be totally unafraid to be wild and weird and, you know, not stick to conventions. So I think that they're really interesting movies to talk about, especially as like a double bill. I mean, man, these two movies as a double feature, I think you'd walk out and your, you know, eyes would be bleeding.
Right. Yeah, I mean, my eyes kind of bleed when I watch just one of them. So I think watching them back to back would probably be pretty insane.
Yeah.
And like with me kind of revisiting these last these three movies over the last couple of days, it really is, it's kind of fun to see where you connect with a lot, because we'll get the Sequence Break a little later. But what I really liked was, whereas both Videodrome and Altered States are kind of looking to the future with the relationship to technology, it's kind of cool that you did kind of the opposite with kind of looking back with technology and that relationship. And I don't know, hopefully we get a chance to talk about that a little more once we get to your movie.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. I'm glad you picked up on that. I'm excited to talk about that shade of it for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead. Definitely. No. I definitely agree. And I think that there's a little bit more with those two films that we're going to talk about, starting with Altered States and Videodrome. Again, they're, like Blaine said, they're very much focused on the future, obviously. And one of the things I loved about your film is that you kind of wrestled with the same themes, but there was also, without overdoing it, there was just enough nostalgia buttons there for me, you know, with some nice video game stuff. So I was like, oh, I love the arcade. I miss the arcade.
I mean, for me, you know, I have an arcade machine in my house. You know, I love arcades, as is evident from the movie. And something that I really wanted to play around with was the idea that, you know, nostalgia can be both, you know, sort of freeing in a way, like when you, you know, see something, like if you hold on to, I don't know, that old VHS tape that you used to watch all the time, even if you never watch it anymore, just seeing it can sort of, you know, free you a little bit from all the bullshit you're having to deal with today. At the same time, it can also be a little bit of a prison where people are unable to move forward because they're so stuck in the past. And with Sequence Break, I really wanted to play with that idea of, you know, how our relationship with nostalgia and with the past and all of that shapes us, and how to have it be a healthy part of our lives.
I like that, and that's definitely, we'll definitely get into that some more. So that's pretty awesome. I know that you're kind of just a big film buff in general. I heard you on the Canon a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Talking about two wildly different movies than what we're talking about today, in that you were talking about some Monty Python greats with Life of Brian and of course, you know,
Holy Grail. And Holy Grail, yeah. Like, man, Monty Python. I'm a huge Monty Python fan. And it was funny, you know, I often credit Monty Python with kind of my first experience with horror, because I remember being a little kid and my parents had rented Monty Python and the Meaning of Life on VHS, and they had like a party where like they had all their friends over to all watch this movie. And I remember as a little kid, I mean, I must have been, God, when did that movie come out? Like 83, something like that.
Yeah, 83 or 84, somewhere in there.
So by the time it hit VHS, I would bet, you know, maybe this was like 87, 88. So I would have been like 4 or 5. And I remember standing in the wandering in and standing behind the couch and seeing the Grim Reaper scene from Monty Python and the Meaning of Life. And I remember, and if you go back and watch it, they kind of play it like a horror movie. You know, it's funny. And yes, like, comedy stuff happens in it, but the way that they dress the Grim Reaper, the way that they present him, the voice they have, you know, to a little kid, that's scary. And I remember, right, you know, being, for lack of a better word, you know, titillated by this idea of something being scary, you know, in a movie, but kind of liking it. Monty Python's always been a part of my life, and I think that, you know, as we're talking about these sort of wild, you know, unafraid filmmakers, I mean, talk about some wild, unafraid filmmakers. You know, even though they're doing comedy and not horror, you know, Monty Python was, you know, they were doing whatever the hell they wanted to do. You know, and out of them, of course, comes Terry Gilliam, who, again, is one of the most fearless filmmakers of all time. So, yeah, I they definitely were a big influence on me, and I continue to be inspired by them.
Yeah, and with kind of that British surrealty and everything like that, there is definitely a connection there with Ken Russell films, where,
oh, for sure,
you know, where you kind of have that very like conservative, you know, very proper British background, but kind of mixed with these, you know, kind of absurd, surreal, blasphemous ideas. So,
oh, completely, yeah, completely.
No, also, and I mean, since I mentioned it, like, why don't we kind of start moving into our first feature, which is the 1980 release by said Ken Russell of Altered States. I mean, Graham, what was kind of the thinking of bringing this one? I know you talked about it a little bit, but I want to just see if you go into a little bit more detail on why you picked this film.
In the basement of one of the country's leading medical schools, Dr. Edward Jessup, candidate for a Nobel Prize, is conducting the most dangerous experiment in the history of science. And the subject of the experiment is himself.
Ask him what kind of an experience I can expect.
It's blacked out.
What happens during these blackout periods is you get the feeling of phenomenal acceleration, like you're being shot out over millions, billions of years. Time simply obliterates.
Your eyes are shooting up with an untested drug that stacks up in the brain and works in the nucleus of the cell, and you don't call that dangerous.
Now, I'm asking you to put the experiment off until we understand a little more in order to minimize the risk.
No way.
I'm really frightened. We could be screwing around with this whole genetic structure. Now, how do we stop this?
We've got millions of years stored away in that computer bank we call our minds. We have got trillions of dormant genes in us, our whole evolutionary past. Perhaps I've tapped into that.
He may be onto something that is beyond our own comprehension. Now, because I believe him, I want this thing stopped.
The hell was that?
You okay?
If you love me, if you love me, Eddie, get fired! Eddie!
Altered States.
Altered States for me is really interesting because at its heart, you know, it's a love story, right? At its heart, you know, this is a movie about a guy that is, you know, caught in between kind of the world of flesh and blood and logic and science, and then the world of this metaphysical cosmic awareness. And he, to me, what's interesting about it is that, you know, you have this film, which I think really has kind of a hard line of, you know, you have these sort of very kind of sterile environments in, you know, the university and the hospital, and even the way the tank is, you know, the tank is very metal and hard and black. And then you cut to these crazy sequences where he's tripping out that are so removed from reality that, you know, it's just a really interesting dichotomy of what this character is going through. And of course, then the arc of it is that by the end, you know, he's sort of pulled out of the void by his love for, and I hate that I am totally blanking on her character's name, but his love for his wife. And that is ultimately what, you know, what I think draws me to that movie and what inspired me with it in terms of Sequence Break. You know, Sequence Break for me is at its heart a love story. I feel like no matter how wild your movie is, and especially this is important in horror, you have to really care about the characters. You know, these are, you know, it has to be a story about people and their relationships first, and then you throw in all this crazy shit that they have to deal with. And I think that that's what Altered States does really well, is you're following Dr. Jessup, and you care about Dr. Jessup. And that's why when he goes through these extreme transformations, we really, you know, are following through to this totally bonkers conclusion, and we buy it 100%.
I think you summarized that really well. So for those who are not, you know, super familiar with the story, I know you hinted, you've talked a little bit about the story. Blaine, why don't you give like the real brief synopsis of, you know, just the plot synopsis?
Yeah, basically we're following a research scientist, a guy named Eddie Jessup, played by, awesomely by William Hurt, who kind of believes in there's other state of consciousness that he can make as real as everyday life. And using the, you know, sensory deprivation and hallucinogenic drugs, he ends up exploring these, you know, quote-unquote altered states. So, yeah, bouncing off that, I mean, this is one of those films that I've seen a lot of times over the years and kind of at different stages of my life, which is kind of fun to watch movies kind of through that lens. So, like, when I first saw this was, you know, I was probably 14 or 15. Did it, a lot of it kind of went over my head. I liked, you know, I liked the trippiness. I liked, you know, it seemed, like, kind of dangerous. But towards the end, it would sort of kind of slope off for me once it kind of got into him actually kind of having to juxtapose this hallucinogenic state with real life and, you know, and the responsibilities that he carries from there. But I mean, revisiting it this time, that second half has rubbed off on me a little bit more. It still kind of loses me towards the ape stage of this all,
the ape man stuff is a little silly.
Because it is such a self-serious film. Like, it's got that really, like, weird, stagnant, clinical conversation that you see in Ken Russell films, completely humorless, and then all of a sudden we're chasing around a missing link. So, like, I feel like it should be more fun, but it's kind of in the wrong movie. but that aside, I mean, it's still, like, I did find the conclusion now as an adult way more impactful rather than just, like, some kind of cool trippy lights, you know, towards the end. So it really kind of grew on me. I mean, Justin, what were kind of, since this is your first time seeing it, what was kind of your reaction to it all?
So my experience with Ken Russell is very limited. I believe I've only ever seen this and The Devils.
Oh, wow.
Wow, never seen Tommy?
Tommy, like the musical?
Yeah.
That's Ken Russell? Okay, yeah. So I'm up to three.
Okay.
Lair of the White Worm?
Lair of the White Worm's on my queue, my lengthy queue. So I'm up to three. Well, then actually knowing Tommy pretty well, that probably puts a little bit more juice into my thought that I think what I feel about his movies are I really love what he's trying to do as far as I can tell, and I don't think he quite gets there. And that's how I kind of felt about this film overall, in that I felt like the ideas were so strong, but like it didn't quite stick the landing for me. Well, that's not really true. The very end is great, but there's that the bulk of the second half, I think it's where Blaine was kind of hitting at too, gets a little bit off with the pacing and the feel, and it just seems like he's not quite doing what I want him to do there.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think that all the caveman missing link stuff, like you said, I see what he's trying to do. But yeah, like rewatching it last night, it's a little bit silly, you know, and it's a little hokey. And I think I'm not exactly sure how, you know, how necessarily I would have done it differently, but I think that what I appreciate about it is that he's going, no, fuck it, we're going to put a caveman in here.
That's true, and I agree with that. I think the thing is that it doesn't work with some of the other tone of the film. Like, I think that I'm totally cool with what he's doing there, if it's maybe in another film. So, like, I think that he just has a hard time maybe, and this, like I said, I'm judging this on three films, but now that you brought up Tommy, I kind of feel this way about that a little bit too. I definitely feel this way about The Devils, is that there's some real weird tonal shifts in his films, and they don't always seem to quite work for me. But now, moving that aside, the themes of this film, the actual, like, the substance of what I feel like is trying to be said and done, I really, really, like, vibe with. I really appreciate. So I think, like, this idea of this man struggling with multiple worlds, with the world of science, the world of, like, the metaphysical, you know, obviously there's a lot of spiritual stuff going on, like, from the time that, like, you know, he talks about up until the age 16, he had visions of Jesus Christ. And then he denounced Christ when, you know, he heard his father say, just muttering the words, terrible, terrible, and on his deathbed. And he just stopped seeing Christ at that point when he, like, kind of denounced Christ. And then, you know, then he flirted with Buddhism but didn't really see it as a religion. He kind of saw it as just a, you know, a practice in or whatever. And, you know, there's just kind of this he's definitely searching for something throughout the whole film. And whether that something is rooted in reality or not, I don't know. And I don't think he knows.
Well, I think that, you know, what something that I noticed this last time watching it is it's really a lot like Isaac Newton's quest for knowledge. I mean, the reason Isaac Newton became a scientist was to prove the existence of God.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why he became a scientist. And I feel like Jessup is sort of on the same path, where he obviously throughout his whole life has been searching for something in which to have faith. You know, he's searching for some greater, you know, greater knowledge or greater being that he can uncover, but he keeps sort of hitting these stumbling blocks where he's not finding it. You know, and then when the sensory deprivation tank sort of becomes available to him, he you know, and then obviously with, like, you know, taking hallucinogens and all this stuff, he's starting to expand his consciousness in such a way where I think he's going, I am so close to finding this other thing.
Right.
And of course, where Ken Russell takes us, my reading of it is where he takes us, is that he really does go on the brink of finding that, of actually transcending our reality and leaving our reality altogether. But then, you know, he's pulled back because of his love. And I think it's a literal thing. Like, I think he literally transforms into a caveman. I know there are other readings of it where it's all kind of in his head, you know. But I choose to believe that it
feels very literal. I mean, he's definitely depicted it.
I think Russell intends it to be literal. I think he intends it to be literal. character role. But I could see how someone would see this and go, well, obviously he's not really a caveman. It's just William Hurt running naked through the streets, you know.
Right, but it's but like you guys both said, I mean, there's nothing to hint that it's not occurring. Like it always, this film always keeps its feet like grounded in reality. So
yeah.
And I'll admit, like, when you frame it within like Isaac Newton and that, like, it does take it and it makes it play in a way that makes more sense, because you think of Isaac Newton, you think kind of like the last of the magicians, you know, kind of a guy who ended up making these great strides in science by basically pursuing, you know, studying things like the Temple of Solomon and Revelation and the Philosopher's Stone. Now I think that's a really cool way to kind of frame Dr. Jessup in the film, because he is like that. They make sure to let you know, like, from the beginning, he's more of a madman than he is a scientist. He's just willing to go further in science than anybody else is willing to go.
Yeah, he's really willing to take the leap, you know, and his colleague keep telling him throughout the movie, you need to stop this, you know, you need right. to, you know, this stuff you're taking is toxic, we need to run more tests, and someone that we're, you know, that's perhaps a more measured scientist that is doing things more by the book, you know, they would say, sure, let's take a year to test this stuff. But
he straight up says, no, that'll take a year, and I'm not ready to do it. He literally says, yeah, that'll take a year, I'm not doing that, you know?
Yeah, like, exactly, and I think he's addicted to this adventure, you know? He's so close, and he feels he's so close. I think it's really interesting, and I mean, I think William Hurt, you know, has you know, can take a lot of the credit for, you know, for this movie being as effective as it is.
Well, and the casting of the films, I think, again, now is something that I note in my limited experience with Ken Russell, is perfect, like in all of it.
Yeah.
Like I'm sorry, like The Devils doesn't work without Oliver Reed.
Sure.
Like, do you know what I mean? And honestly, you know, knowing more about Tommy, some of those casting choices are just phenomenal. And now knowing, you know, starting to run that through my head as we're talking of like some of the people in there, like I think that fits there too. But one of the things that I found that just keeps coming into my head as we're having this conversation, it's kind of a callback to a previous episode that Graham, you might not have heard of our podcast probably. But a friend of the podcast that we had on named Stephen Biro, he owns and operates Unearthed Films.
Okay.
And extreme horror stuff. Stephen told us his conversion story. And his conversion story really focuses a large part on experimenting with nitrous oxide and LSD to get into another plane, essentially, and meeting God and the devil. And wow. And 100%. He believes every bit of this, and I believe that like this has really happened to him in the regard of how he explained it to us, and how much is in his head and how much is reality. He doesn't know and doesn't really, I don't think, care. But it's so much about that in a weird way. I'm thinking about him experimenting with these drugs reminds me so much of what William Hurt's doing here in this film, and that he was trying to find what was there, what was bigger, what was. He's searching, and that's totally what William Hurt's doing here. And so it's funny that I keep coming back to this, you know, Stephen, if you're listening, you know, I don't think you're crazy. I just think you're kind of a modern day madman who experimented with this and then got to that point. You know, he found his God, and I don't know if William Hurt ever fully found it, you know, because he got brought back maybe before it fully took shape, but wow.
Yeah, I feel like I feel like the end of the movie is us seeing him about to cross that threshold. He is about to see God, you know, and he's right there, and that's why the ending is so impactful for me, because he chooses to come back. You know.
Oh yeah, that's definitely true.
You know, but yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the question also could be asked of, like, how much when we're searching for something, are we more likely to find it? You know, like, is he in going to all these great lengths in order to find, I'll call it finding God, you know, in order to find God, does that mean that he's more likely to find it? Like, if he were, you know, if he didn't have any of that backstory about you know, having used to, you know, he used to see images of Jesus Christ, and he's always been searching for this. You know, if you were just like a cold clinical scientist and still went through all these steps, would he have still had this same experience? And I don't really think so. You know, which again, it makes it just really nebulous of, is he really finding it? Is he just tripping out? Is it in his head? You know, and does any of that matter? Because obviously it's impacted him in this profound way, and maybe that's all that matters.
Hmm. You mentioned, any thoughts on that, Blaine? Anything to add on that?
No, I mean, like, on that part, I mean, I'm with you on the part that it's difficult to know what is actually, like, what the reality of it is. So when he turns away from it, I mean, as a viewer, like, it is impactful. But it's another side when you start to think, like, would this guy, is based on what we watched the other, you know, hour and 39 minutes of it, I keep wondering, would this guy actually turn back? Is there enough? Having a wife and a child already wasn't enough. So it's
sure,
so,
that's fair.
So it's tough. I mean, I do. I mean, it makes a much better ending.
So you're saying maybe he only turned back temporarily. You know, it might not be the end of the story.
Yeah, I don't think this guy could keep himself out of a tank, even at that point. And it would be, I would be curious to see what the next 6 months were like of him trying to get back to that state, because he is just so driven. I mean, even when, you know, when he's out with the the tribe in South America, you know, it's like, this is a guy who is determined, and it's one of those things where you're just like, man, I wonder what the next, like, if there was 10 more minutes of this movie, what the hell would happen?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting, like, every time I watch it, and I'm with you, I think that the first time I watched this, it went totally over my head, and I wasn't really into it, and then the more times I watch it, the more I find in it. I think that, you know, every time I watch it, I note that it's a flawed movie, and there's a lot of stretches of it that aren't entirely enjoyable, because it is pretty clinical, and, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot of that dialogue is purposefully very technical, you know, where we don't understand a word of what they're saying, and there's sort of, you know, I can just hear Ken Russell, because apparently there was a lot of, like, on-set fighting between Ken Russell and Patty Chayefsky, the author, where Ken Russell, I think, wanted way less dialogue and more of these, you know, trippy sequences. And then, you know, the screenwriters were saying, no, you've got to stick word for word. So my understanding was Ken Russell just directed the actors to say it as fast as they could.
And that makes so much sense, because that dialogue, it's so funny because you're watching, you know, like Bob Balaban and everyone, you know, acting pretty natural, but, like, spouting out this unnatural, just clinical nonsense at, like, lightning speed, and you know, and also, you know, then you'll see those parts where they're just, like, trying to get as much as they can by saying, like, oh, hey, I talked to so and so, and they told me, and then they start listing out this long list back and forth. But yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense with how that would have gone, because, I mean, as far as I mean, my knowledge of a lot of films by Ken Russell, he kind of always kind of ended up running into those kinds of problems on set, because, like, Crimes of Passion, like, you look at that compared to the source material, and apparently that was, like, another one that was just a huge battle all the way through for him to just kind of be able to follow what he wanted to make.
Yeah, and I mean, you see his films, and you can understand why he might clash with someone that is trying to make a more traditional motion picture.
Right. Yeah, and excellent. Well, also, well, I mean, we've talked about Altered States a lot. Why don't we move into the next one by another brilliant filmmaker of that time, and that's 1983's Videodrome. Hey, Justin, tell us about it.
Why would anybody watch a scum show like Videodrome? Why did you watch it, Max? Business reasons. Sure. What about the other reasons?
Max Wren is a victim.
I woke up with a headache.
He has been exposed to Videodrome.
I've been hallucinating for a while, ever since...
What?
Since I first saw Videodrome.
His brain is already receiving video images. I think that massive doses of Videodrome signal will ultimately produce and control hallucination to the point that it will change human reality. Soon, his visions will coalesce and become uncontrollable flesh. Videodrome is seducing Max Wren.
Please, come to me now. Come to Nikki.
And Max Wren can do nothing to stop it.
What makes you think I need help?
None of our test subjects has returned to normality.
Television can change your mind. Videodrome will change your body.
Long live the new flesh.
It will shatter your reality.
Videodrome.
Starring Deborah Harry and James Woods. A shocking new vision from the creator of Scanners. Coming soon to a theater near you from Universal Pictures.
Well, you know, I'm not good at this synopsizing thing. That's why I would throw it to you. But, you know, I'm going to pass it back to you. You're better at this, man.
Man works for TV station. Man finds snuff channel. Man fucks TV. Man grows a vagina. Let's go.
That's basically it. There you go. See, that's why I throw it to you, my friend.
There you go.
But yeah, so.
Right there.
Well, thanks, guys. But yeah, Graham. I mean, you know, with picking this, I mean, yeah, I think we're picking up on a theme here, which you discussed earlier. But what was kind of your experiences with Videodrome? Because I know as movie fans, I think everybody in our generation has a similar kind of relationship with this film. You know, given its kind of cult status over the years, and most people's love for David Cronenberg.
Yeah, I don't think this was my first Cronenberg movie I ever saw. I want to say that was The Fly, but I was in high school, and there was a buddy of mine that was, you know, a pretty big film buff, and I was a film buff too, but this friend of mine was, like, way more, you know, knowledgeable about stuff than I was, and he knew that I was really into horror stuff, and he said, oh, have you seen Videodrome? And I'd always heard that title, and maybe I had, like, you know, come across a picture of it in an old Fangoria or something at some point, you know, but I'd never seen it. And I turned it on, and I fully admit, the first time I watched it, I had no idea what was happening, but I was totally captivated by it. And I think that that's probably true for a lot of people that are watching Videodrome. I think even today, having seen it, you know, probably, you know, like a couple dozen times, I still couldn't fully tell you what's going on in that movie. But I think that's part of the power of it is that, you know, Cronenberg, I definitely think it's his wildest film. I think that it's his most surreal film. And I think that it's, you know, of all of his movies that are sort of purely extracted from the soul of David Cronenberg, I think it's Videodrome. You know, and for me, I mean, just briefly, the connection to Sequence Break is just, this is such obviously a movie about our relationship to technology, and being able to do what Cronenberg does best, which is take metaphor and make it literal. You know, like you said, he fucks a TV, you know?
And, right, yeah.
And the making literal of the cancer, you know, and all, you know, just the way that he plays around with you know, with perception and with these, you know, hallucinations and these bodily transformations. I think it's just, it's Cronenberg firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably because I saw it first, but I'm one of those weirdos that prefers Existence to Videodrome, but I think they both hit on the same themes. So
they definitely do.
I mean, to a large extent, Existence is kind of like the next generation of Videodrome, and I think it's just because I saw it first that I have an affinity for it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it definitely feels like a spiritual
almost like Videodrome Part 2. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like the sequel, unofficial or at least spiritual sequel, you know, like you said. And so, you know, It's very much how to describe the film. I don't even know. It's so weird and so just like twisted. But like, I was having a conversation on Twitter about this film when I was kind of prepping for this episode, and how I was a sociology major in college, and I'm still kind of like a sociologist at heart in a lot of ways. And we talked a lot in a couple of my classes about the idea of like technological somnambulism, otherwise known as, you know, just like sleepwalking through technology. Like, and you kind of just keep advancing and advancing until one day you realize that it's like overtaken you.
Hmm.
And to a large extent, that's kind of what this is. You know what I mean? Like, people are just so like immerse themselves so much into, you know, this in the regards of the 80s. We're talking about kind of the birth of the television culture, you know, but one of the cool things that someone pointed out to me on Twitter when we were having this conversation, Garrett Smith, who writes for our website and will be a guest on the show later this year, Garrett was talking about how this movie almost predicted like the internet and like sure. the way we interact with the internet. And it's so interesting to think of it that way, because it totally is.
I the last time I watched it, it was probably last year sometime, and I noted that too, because it feels like, you know, ultimately I think the main theme of Videodrome is a fear and a fascination of new technology, and especially, you know, back in the early 80s, you know, this idea of you know, the growth of the television. It's now a household item. These, you know, radio waves are flying through the air and into your house. And, you know, what is that? I mean, we still debate what that does to us, you know, like we still talk about God or our cell phones giving us cancer. And this sort of, the taking of that idea and turning it into a religious fascination. You know, this worship of this new technology, which I think happens with every major technological boom. You know, Videodrome was talking about television and VHS, you know, and then, you know, then we're into the internet, and now it's, you know, like with Black Mirror, they're talking about, you know, like iPhones and iPads and all this interconnectivity. And so I totally agree. I think that Videodrome sort of predates that, and it predicts our sort of it's a lustful fascination. You know, we don't get anything. When I say lustful, I mean I think that we don't get anything like totally like personal or soulful from our relationship with our devices, but we do get something really exciting.
Yes, it's the titillation.
Yeah, and especially, you know, how they make it in Videodrome. It's about these snuff films, you know, this forbidden fruit of what we're not supposed to watch. You know, I mean, this is already a company that deals in softcore porn, but it's about going to the extreme and really, you know, diving into that dark underbelly that you're not supposed to, which I think is interesting.
No, absolutely. I mean, and with my relationship with this movie, it's kind of funny, because when I did come across this film, I was kind of at like my most like voracious point in my life when it came to film. I was, you know, trading tapes. I was watching everything I could get my hands on. And I essentially was like the moral of this story. Like, I wanted something more. I wanted, you know, every time I was renting stuff, I was wanting to see something more extreme, something different, something that, you know, that kept that titillation going, kind of chasing that kind of that kind of temporary high of seeing things that you're just not supposed to see, you know. And, you know, you got someone sending you tapes, they're like, oh, it's from Japan, it's so fucked up, and, you know. And then I remember, you know, in the midst of this, you know, finally getting my way through all the Cronenberg films, and this one just struck a chord, because I was like, oh, holy shit, this is me. And this is like most of the people that I know, like, we're, you know, we're consuming, we're just consuming massive amounts, trying to kind of chase whatever excitement that we initially got from, you know, extreme films and you know, and going further and further with these ideas. So, I mean, that's what it's came across. But, I mean, like, this has always been probably my favorite Cronenberg movie because I'd seen a few before. You know, I had seen, you know, Shivers. I had seen, of course, The Fly. But this one just, like, it just resonated because I got it. and with a lot of my personal tastes, I mean, I've talked about it on the show a lot, I don't really care about story as much as I like the surreal nature that telling the story. And I mean, as much as Cronenberg does that, especially in films like Naked Lunch, I feel like he does it best in this film. Like, because you can't say that you know exactly, nobody knows what's going on, but I feel like he keeps that tone and that vibe so precise throughout the film that you don't really need that answer, and you kind of give over to the absurdity and go, okay, you know, of course this makes sense, especially with Rick Baker's, like, gooeyest, like, heaving special effects that I just think just kind of adds to the the perverseness of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Cronenberg, you know, has just thrown out the need for logic or, you know, traditional storytelling in this movie, which is why, you know, it feels almost like, you know, this is Cronenberg's Eraserhead, you know, right. Like this is he just throws all of it out, whereas his other movies, you know, are still telling, you know, essentially a plot that we can kind of follow. And in this, I mean, yeah, there's a plot, you know, you could say, you know, a guy that works for a TV station finds a snuff channel and it starts to fuck with his head, and then he grows a cancer gun on his arm, you know. Like, you could say that, but I think it's more about, this is more about dealing with, like, pure metaphor and pure, you know, pure emotions and just making the subtext literal, which I think is why it's so interesting and kind of feels, you know, unbridled. It just feels like Cronenberg's really just kind of putting it all straight up on the surface and then letting us figure it out.
Yeah, no, I mean, and so, Blaine, that's what makes it's funny, Blaine and I share a lot of films we both love, but they tend to be the films that both do narrative and the weird stuff well, because he's more interested in how it makes him feel, and I care about narrative more than him. So now that said, maybe that's part of why I like Existence a little bit better when I mentioned that, because, like, I follow it a little bit better.
Sure, yeah, totally.
Yeah, and maybe as someone who has, you know, grown up and always felt, you know, drawn towards the more narrative side, I think that may be why. But that said, like, this film is visually stunning and grotesque. Outside of maybe Screaming Mad George is stuff in, like, society and stuff like that, it's one of the gooeyest things I've ever seen in my life.
It's totally gooey, and it's totally different. You know, like with Screaming Mad George, it's, when you see this movie, you haven't seen prosthetics like this. This is,
no.
There's nothing to compare it to.
No, not at all. And I mean, and there's definitely, yeah, it's not something to compare it to at all. But I definitely think it's wildly influential to a lot of people, you know, in a lot of film, a lot of other kinds of art, not just film. I mean, the amount that this film has influenced, you know, modern heavy metal music, you know, as far as, like, people sample stuff from Videodrome, like, all the time, like, clips.
Interesting.
And
I didn't know that.
And I see it in, like, the kind of the hardcore metal world a lot, especially in, like, some of the really aggressive, extreme type bands. And I think it makes sense that it does, because it's, there's a lot to that. But I mean, overall, I think, I can totally see how this is a big influence to you. And to say that Sequence Break is a little bit gooey would be an understatement as well.
Yes.
So with that, I kind of want to, you know, kind of move into, your film, a little bit, and while we were a little more spoilery with the old films, because I'm sorry, the you know, 80 and 83, I don't feel like I ruined anything for anybody. Sequence Break has not released wide yet. Will be coming out on Shudder. In a few weeks?
I'm not exactly sure of the date, but yeah, it'll be okay. In 2018. I think probably within the next, you know, several months.
Okay, cool. So sometime in the first half of the year or so, people are going to be able to see this film. They're going to have, be able to talk about it. And without getting too spoilery, Graham, why don't you give us a real brief synopsis of your film?
I got some bad news. We're going to have to close up shop.
Like forever?
Yeah. I got to go up north for a couple of weeks. You're going to have to look after the shop, take care of things. You spend enough time making other people's games beautiful. Do something for you, okay?
Hey, man. Look, you can't be in here.
Don't just look into the void. Let the void look in to you.
I'm Tess.
Oz.
Oz? Really?
Yeah, it's short for Osgood.
For fuck's sake, Tess, I'm fine.
You have a higher purpose.
Break the sequence. Be the man I could never be.
Sequence Break tells the story of Oz, played by Chase Williamson, who's a reclusive video arcade repair technician. So he rebuilds and repairs old arcade units. And he ends up on the same day as learning that his shop is going to close down. He meets this young woman, Tess, played by Fabienne Therese, and has a personal connection with her. That he hasn't really had with anybody else. And he also finds a mysterious circuit board for a new game that has been dropped off at the shop. And he plugs in the game and starts to play it, and it begins to cause him to have hallucinations and cause his reality to be warped. And while his relationship with Tess grows stronger, so does his... I'll call it an affair with this arcade machine, which may or may not be sentient. Then things get super goopy and super weird and super surreal. And he goes down the rabbit hole of trying to figure out what this machine is doing to him and why it's doing it to him. And who is this mysterious raving man that keeps breaking into his shop?
Right. So he's kind of crazy. And I think that's a good place to leave the synopsis, so we don't ruin anything for anyone. But man, the influence, especially Videodrome, jumps out right away to me as in what the influence is. You know, you were talking about, this technology that can literally kind of meld with you or be part of you, and you can be part of it, and how that all works, and you're kind of flirting with those themes as well, And also, I guess with Altered States, I could see how, the obsession of the scientist probably fits in a lot to where Oz kind of goes. And I guess some of the other, other thematic things that we discussed kind of really fit in there too.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, I think a common thread with Altered States and Videodrome that were both an influence on my movie is that idea of obsession. And with Sequence Break, I really lean heavily into equating obsession with lust and exploring the effects that can have on somebody, especially in relation to to your relationships with other people. You know, I wrote Sequence Break largely because I was sort of at a crossroads of going, you know, how do I have a fulfilled life, you know, as a husband, and, you know, wanting to have a family and have that, you know, aspect of my life, with also being, you know, an artist and an actor. And because sometimes those things, you know, like as an actor, you could have to go away for 2 months all of a sudden, and that's really hard, you know? And so it's like, how do you balance those things? And so Sequence Break in a lot of ways was me, you know, trying to explore my relationship between, you know, your, like, your personal passion and then your passion that is tied into other people. And sort of playing with those themes, which I think is true with, like, with Altered States. You know, Jessup clearly, you know, cares about his wife, but he also, you know, he cannot stop his obsession with his work. You know, I think with Max Wren and Videodrome, we don't so much have him. He has his relationship with Debbie Harry, but that is also more of, like, a lustful, like, obsession thing.
I mean, don't we all have a lustful obsession with Debbie Harry?
We definitely do. But that's, you know, so it's less about, for him, I think it's more about diving straight into the obsession and how that can ultimately destroy you, or set you free. You know, I guess it depends on your reading at the end of that movie. But then with Sequence Break, yeah, it's about, you know, this guy's sort of push and pull between his nostalgic past that he loves and hangs on to, and this potential but frightening future with this girl, and how does that play on him?
Yeah, and that's one thing I really liked with Sequence Break. Probably something that I think you do much better in your films than either, you know, Videodrome or Altered States, is when you put together, you know, the guy and the girl, you know, between Oz and Tess.
Oz and Tess.
Which I love the chemistry that's already kind of there between Chase Williamson and, how do you pronounce her name? Fabiana Teresi?
Fabian.
Fabian. Okay. And, I mean, so I think those two, I mean, it does have just such a good chemistry in there where everything feels very, very organic in their relationship. Like, even that, with things moving quickly, you know, to, you know, make an hour and a half movie, it feels natural, and you kind of root for it more than you would in something that's a little colder, like the other two films we talked about. I think that warmth really plays well on that side, and it makes more sense that it came from, you know, things that you were already kind of dealing with, and rather than, you know, kind of this alien version of love and lust from the other films.
Thanks. Yeah, that was important to me. You know, my one major criticism, I would say generally of all of Cronenberg's movies, with the exception, I think, of The Fly, is that they are pretty cold, and we don't really care that much about the characters. It's more about the ideas, right. You know, the ideas and sort of, you know, the visual language that he's using. And I think even with Altered States, where they focus more on that relationship, it's not as it's still pretty cold, and you know, ultimately it's not like, you're not like weeping for them at the end, you know, it's a really interesting idea. And so I wanted to, with Sequence Break, you know, really have it be a love story, sort of be a love story first, and then put that love story inside of this bonkers, you know, movie. So I'm glad that came across.
Oh, absolutely. Because yeah, I feel like the other two films, there were movies that I feel like they had to put some sort of love story in it, where you built those ideologies around that love story. But we had talked about before a little bit earlier in the show, but this idea of looking to the past rather than looking to the future with technology, which I think is pretty common with kind of, we're all in around the same age group, you know, that with our generation, where we are heavily, you know, nostalgia based, and, you know, how did that kind of come along, or is that just kind of natural?
Yeah, you know, I think that, like, right now especially, we're seeing a whole bunch of, you know, especially in horror, a whole bunch of film and television that is really heavily steeped in nostalgia. You know, you look at Stranger Things, you know, you look at, I mean, even the movie I was in, Beyond the Gates.
Yeah, Beyond the Gates is definitely very nostalgia, you know,
driven. You know, where it's all this stuff is very, is it's nostalgia driven, and that's a good thing, you know. I mean, it's, I love it. And, you know, I think of, you know, like I'm looking at my shelf right now and I have VHS tapes on it. And what's funny to me is, you know, I think of, gosh, you know, yeah, I own a VCR. When was the last time I watched a VHS tape? Why do I hold on to these? You know, what is it about this piece of technology, or like this, this old Nintendo cartridge that I never play anymore? Like, what is it about this that gives me comfort? What is it about this that, you know, what is it about, like, watching Beyond the Gates and seeing, you know, you know, seeing all those VHS tapes in that store? What is it about that that gives us, you know, that warm feeling? Or, you know, what is it about watching Stranger Things and, you know, having this sort of inner smile when they're talking about, you know, when they're riding bikes in their neighborhood and talking about Ghostbusters? like what is that? And so I think that right now we're really at a time when we, as, you know, our sort of generation are kind of, you know, now we're the ones that are making the art, and we're the ones that are that are kind of in charge of where the zeitgeist is going. And for whatever reason, we're looking back. And I just find that really interesting. You know, it's not for good or ill or whatever. I just I find that it's sort of an interesting wave of the zeitgeist right now. And so I wanted to explore, you know, how is that dangerous? You know, is that mutually exclusive from continuing to move forward? You know, and I think that, I mean, because, you know, like I'll read some, you know, some reviews, you know, on, you know, like, I don't know, like I'll read a review of a new horror movie, and everything that I read in it is, well, but it's not as good as they were in the 80s, you know,
right?
Or it's not as good as they were in the 70s. And it, to me, it's just sort of an interesting notion of going, gosh, but is that really a fair, you know, a fair comparison? You know, is that, you know, does, you know, do we color our experiences differently when we are looking back at something that we used to love when we were a kid? And I think inevitably we do, you know, and so I just kind of, you know, I wanted to play with all those, you know, I wanted to throw all those ideas sort of into a melting pot and have Oz, you know, really struggle with this idea of the past versus the future. And, you know, not have it be a thing of the past is evil, the future's good. You know, it's like, it's not that. It's, but it's an exploration of that struggle, which I think is sort of important for us right now to examine.
Well, and a lot of times people in like horror groups online and things will say things like, what's your favorite, you know, decade of horror? And I've honestly been telling people, I think it might be now, but I have to wait. Like, I'm not sure, you know, like I think that this decade is a really good decade for horror, but you know, we're not looking at this decade with the glasses that we're looking at the 80s or the 70s or, you know, a lot of people hate the 90s in a lot of ways, but I think the 90s were pretty amazing. So, you know, but, you know, it, ultimately, I think that we're looking at things through a different set of glasses, a different lens, you know, and I think that that has a lot to do with what you're saying there, is that you're judging the now or whatever based on an unfair comparison that's, you know, really sugar-coated by your adolescence and your other memories and the things you associate that with. And, I mean, I guess if you had a really, really shitty adolescence, you might not have a whole lot of nostalgia.
For sure. Sure.
You know?
Well, yeah, I think with Oz's character in Sequence Break, you know, one thing that I was, you know, really wanting to kind of play with is that it's not even really, you know, in his control. You know, his... He is so held by his love for old arcade games and his you know, his obsession with them and his need, you know, that's really kind of the only you know, I'll call it a person that he, you know, has connects with. Well, he connects with his the shop owner Jerry, but I think because they're, you know, totally kindred spirits in that regard. You know, but I think that, you know, he's such a character that is searching for a connection, and I think is afraid of the new. And I think that in a lot of ways, you know, if you grew up in the 80s and the 90s, then your relationship with things like VHS tapes or the movies that came out then, if you're a movie person, you know, it's obviously going to be something that has this kind of, you know, hold on you that you don't even really realize that it has, you know, where maybe, you know, it's like there was a movie that I used to watch all the time when I was a kid called The Flight of Dragons. It's an old Rankin Bass cartoon.
Right.
And I watched it constantly. And a couple years ago, I saw that it was playing at the Egyptian here in L.A. And I was like, oh, my God, this movie on the big screen, I want to go see it. And as I was driving there, I had this, like, knot in my stomach going, oh, man, I hope it holds up, you know? I hope it's what I remember, because that's really frightening. And there was a part of me that was going, gosh, do I even want to go see this? Or do I want to just have it be in my memory as this really beautiful thing? And fortunately, that movie totally holds up. Just going to say that. But the point being is that, you know, I think that we our generation is really our childhood and, you know, really powerful surge of technology that happened as we were growing up, I think all combined to give us to give us a nostalgia, a really important part of our lives.
Definitely. I mean, I think that feels like a good way to kind of summarize this conversation. And so, you know, one of the things we like to do before we wrap up is we like to kind of leave the audience, the listeners, the whatever you friends, whoever we want to call the folks listening right now, with a couple recommendations based on what we're talking about or just things we've seen recently. And if you would like to participate, if you have an idea of something you'd like to recommend folks check out besides the films we talked about today,
sure, yeah, to
share as well. So, okay. Blaine, do you have a recommendation prepared?
Yeah, this week I wanted to talk about another film, not really in the mix based on ideology, but more just based around Ken Russell, because I love a lot of his films, and they're just now, a lot of them are just now starting to make that jump to Blu-ray and DVD, and one of my favorites is the 1984 film Crimes of Passion, starring Kathleen Turner and Anthony Perkins. It's recently gotten a release through Arrow Video on Blu-ray. It looks absolutely beautiful. It's got tons and tons of extras on it, which I can barely make my way through them, but it is such a weird movie. You know, like kind of hot, you know, off the heels of Altered States, you know, just a few years after, he releases this weirdo movie about a like high power fashion exec, you know, played by Kathleen Turner, who's still really at like a really foxy level of her career. And she decides she gets bored in her marriage, so she starts becoming a $50 prostitute at night. And she's just wandering the streets. It's got this bizarre script that doesn't feel human at all. Everything everyone says is just bizarre and feels almost foreign in a way that's like otherworldly. And but what's great about the movie is it makes everything feel so perverse. And you have this amazing performance by Anthony Perkins, probably my second favorite role of his outside of the Psycho films, as playing this like just unhinged street preacher who's out, you know, we eventually find is, you know, perpetrating these horrific crimes that the film's kind of framed around. But yeah, it's really bizarre. Kathleen Turner gets called China Blue is her prostitute name. And if you want to dig a little deeper after watching Crimes of Passion, go and visit his 1987 release, Whore, which is equally as strange, but breaks the fourth wall in a way that is like, it's like just designed for watching with a bunch of buddies and drinking beers. So yeah, check that one out. Let me know what you think of it.
Definitely. I've never seen that one. And it's been on my long queue as well. I'm going to recommend something that's not necessarily in any way connected to our conversation today.
Oh, great.
It's something I just revisited. I know, right? I just revisited it this week, and as one of the websites I write for, Synapse does like a weekly film club kind of thing where we all kind of just give our 2 cents. They call it 2 cents. We watched I Don't Feel at Home in This World Anymore, which is the
Michael Blair film. Oh, it's a great movie.
Amazing.
Dude, I rewatching that film, it climbed back up into my top 10. I hadn't watched it since the beginning of the year. It's definitely one of my top 10 of the year. Just a quirky, weird, fun, like, crime thriller slash comedy slash I don't even know what to call it. Other than just a fun, offbeat movie with two amazing performances. I mean, more than two, but two lead performances that with Elijah Wood and Melanie Lynskey that are just phenomenal. And the direction, Macon Blair's direction is just, it's just fantastic. And it's just a film that really jumps out at me as one that folks are going to be talking about for years. They may not appreciate how much they're going to appreciate. So that's just me. So there's my little recommendation, just because I love it. And how about you, Graham?
Yeah, I'll throw out a couple films, actually.
Great.
One of them, both of them are sort of in this vein of I think, a combination of, like, technology and the metaphysical. So one of them is from a couple years ago called Beyond the Black Rainbow.
Yes.
It's a super trippy story about a young girl with telekinetic powers that is kept in an institute by sort of an evil psychiatrist. But this one is way more about, sort of form over function a little bit. It's not so much about the story as it is about the really insane visuals. I almost call it like a tone poem. Like, you got to just sit down and let this movie wash over you. You know, turn off all of your cell phones, turn off all your lights, crank the volume, and let this movie just roll over you like a wave of insanity.
That's been on my list for a while, and I have not checked it out, so I'm going to have to rush to do that. It's been back in the spotlight a little bit because of his new film coming out.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I'm really excited about that, and I think that you'll I understand some of the criticisms people have about this movie, but I mean, for me, when I first saw it, I was fortunate enough to see it on the big screen. Which is why I don't know how well it would work, like, if you're watching it on your laptop or you're watching it, you know, at home and you're, like, you know, doing dishes or something. But, like, you know, just sit down and watch this movie and let it experience it. It's really an experiential film. The other film I wanted to mention is a movie that I revisit every few months, and I find new stuff in it every time, and that is Danny Boyle's Sunshine.
Oh,
I've never seen Sunshine.
Have you ever seen movies, Justin?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I've never seen it, man.
Sunshine is is becoming one of my favorite sci-fi films. I really love this movie. I think it's an interesting exploration of technology and science in relation to our concept of God, which is why I think it really ties into what we've been talking about today. So I think it would make a really interesting pairing with altered states, in terms of, you know, our, you know, like, what obsession can do to us. But I think what Danny Boyle's really great at is the human element of this movie is very, very strong.
Awesome.
It's a great movie. I highly recommend it. And I'll just say, on the Blu-ray, there are two commentaries on the Blu-ray. One of them is Danny Boyle, which is really interesting. The other one is Professor Brian Cox, who is an astrophysicist who was the science advisor on the film. And so you have a whole commentary track of this incredibly smart astrophysicist sort of walking you through the real science behind all this trippy insanity that you're watching in the movie. And it's, like, totally fascinating. And if you're a science nerd, you'll totally love it.
Awesome. Well, that's really awesome to know. There's another kind of reason to pick it up if you want to, you know, kind of get a movie with, like, some weird, interesting, real science behind some out there stuff, which is really cool. So now I'm going to have to check out the film, and I'm going to have to make sure that I pick up the Blu-ray so I can watch that too. So,
perfect.
So thanks for spending my money, Graham.
You're very welcome.
But with that, Graham, I want to give you one last opportunity to tell folks where they can check you out and follow the progress on, you know, what you're doing and you know, what's coming up with your movies and your life and whatever.
You know, you can always find me on Twitter at Graham Skipper. You know, I got a website, GrahamSkipper.com. And that's kind of where all the news about stuff coming out is. Sequence Break, like I said, is coming out this year on Shudder. If you are a horror fan and you do not subscribe to Shudder already, you are totally missing out. Shudder, I've been a customer of theirs for years, so I'm really happy that they're the ones that picked us up. It's a great service. It's you know, very affordable. And as a horror fan, it's sort of a must have. But yeah, so pick up Shudder and keep an eye out for Sequence Break. You know, I've got some other acting stuff that I've been doing. I'm in a film called Downrange that
I actually had a chance to review that as part of the Midnight Madness from TIFF.
Nice, excellent. I'm really
very very really, very. You go ahead. Sorry.
Very violent. It's very violent.
Yeah, yeah, and I was very happy to see you pop in when you did too. I was like, oh, it's Graham Skipper. Thanks.
Yeah, that was a real treat to get to work with. Ruhei Kitamura, I've always been a big fan of his, so that's a really fun movie. Check it out. And I've got some other stuff on the horizon, and so yeah, just come check me out on Twitter and say hi, and I'll probably babble some weird nerdy stuff at you.
No, sounds good. Well, or just at say, hey Graham, we like you, come be on our podcast, and he just said okay. So hey,
yeah man, I love to talk this stuff.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Graham, and We look forward to you know, what you got coming up, and you know, definitely reach out again when we see that you got more stuff coming up, and so you're not gonna get away from us just yet.
No, please do. I had a blast. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you again, and thank you for everybody for tuning in for this episode. We're going to be back again in 2 weeks. We got a whole lot of stuff planned for February. We're going to be celebrating both Black History Month with Blaxploitation films with special guests, as well as Women in Horror. So everybody stick around. We'll see you next time, and peace.